League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Get ready. Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is almost here. It's Black Friday in July, and it's coming your way. For 5 days only, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus amazing doorbuster deals and free shipping on everything. Yes, everything right to your door. So mark your calendars. Wayfair's Black Friday in July sale starts July 24th. Shop everything home at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small caps. So welcome, Paul.
Hi, Paul, and hello, everyone. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, well, it's been another busy 7 days. In fact, we've had the FTSE touching 9,000 this week. Oh, yeah. We've got the S&P 500 on a PE ratio of just over 22 times. NASDAQ is on just over 30 times. And I can see you've got a lot of money there pinned at the back of your wall. So you've been rolling in it. And so,
well, I didn't put this up deliberately for this. I just did that the other night when I found some Channel Islands. £20 and £1. I found out they still use £1 notes in Alderney. And somebody actually in a bar, they gave me it. He said, just have one, because I was amazed at this. And I said, that's incredibly generous of you. He said, you bought me a pint last night. Don't you remember? I said, no. So that's why my Channel Island money is on the wall.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, so you've been rolling in it. You've been making a lot of money. And they're all investors. Have you been buying or selling anything over the last week or so?
Well, actually, I haven't been making money the last couple of weeks. I don't know why, but my portfolio seems a bit stuck in the mud. I've had about two mild profit warnings now from MS International and can't remember the other one. But I seem to, it's sort of one step forward, one step back at the moment for me personally. Yeah, a bit frustrating, actually. I've added a few bits and pieces. You know, I knew he was good. I should have written these down, shouldn't I? I just seem to go blank. I can't remember. Yeah, okay. Nothing major, anyway, just a few. Yeah, okay. Oh, I've done a couple of trades. I've actually made a bob or two on Mobico. I thought that was quite interesting. That was a little speculative.
They're the coach boys, aren't they? They're the buses and coaches. Ones.
Yeah. It used to be National Express. Horrible balance sheet, not an investment, but as a trade. They've just pointed out yesterday the US sale has completed. So they're now, they've got loads of liquidity, ample, as they called it, and no debt maturities for 2 years. So I think there's a bit of a trading opportunity there that this might re-rate because it's got a very good Iberian coach business, and the rest of the group's a load of junk basically, but and the balance sheet's optically bad. So I think that's an interesting trade. We had two very good trades this morning for the readers, both of which have worked. I flagged up Cohort pre 8 a.m. and said this is an ahead of expectations update. It's a very good company, and that shot up about 15%. I also flagged up that I thought
Have you bought Cohort?
No, it's too expensive. It's too expensive for me. But I've gone back positive about it because it's now growing strongly into the valuation, and I think it's one of those ones where you just have to look through the high PE. And I mean, the update today was exceptional, and they say they have, you know, they've got the right products at the right time when the defense industry is all coming back strongly. Although client concentration is high, 50% with the UK MOD, but they seem to have the right sort of product. So I think I did go amber on Cohort. We were strong supporters of it for a couple of years, got to a really top evaluation, so we went amber on it. But this morning I moved it back up to amber green because it was such a good update. It's one of those things that's now really outperforming and growing into the valuation. And that looks set to continue. So I like
it. When would you take profits on it? I mean, as you say, it trades.
Nobody knows. You just don't know, Paul, do you? You know what it's like. It's so tempting, isn't it, to bank profits when somebody something gets to a PE of 30 or something.
Or top slicing. In your portfolio, what percentage would you start top slicing?
It's normally if I see something else more compelling. So I'll typically top slice maybe 10% of a position that's looking like it's fully valued. But I don't know about you, but I find once you've kind of broken that spell, you tend to carry on top slicing, and it's rare for me to continue to hold it a month or two later. So usually top slicing is the beginning of the end for that position. But everyone, what's your approach, Paul? Because you take chunky positions. So presumably you can't sell in one go.
Sometimes it depends how liquid the stock is, but typically if I've got a high conviction play, I'll let it run until 20% of my portfolio. That's a really sort of like, you know, I've had for a long time. And then after it gets 20%, I tend to then start top slicing and taking some profit off the table. But if it's something that is, you know, I've only bought recently and it isn't high conviction, I'm just getting lucky and it sort of like, you know, has a take, which hasn't happened ever. But if it did, then I'd actually, I would top slice before 20% because I'd some banks and profits. But for something like this, which is a long-term winner with secular themes, I would just look at it and just think, well, traditionally defense stocks have traded around about 12 to 15 times PE, and they're all trading at double that, between 25 and 30. So personally, if I was owning defense stocks, I'd probably trim actually, but I'm not. I don't know. It's not. I haven't got that sort of. I haven't got that quality problem.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's always the most difficult question that every investor says when they're asked, when do you sell? There's just no golden rule. It's I just have a simple approach, really. It tends to be when I found something else that I think is significantly more compelling, then I'll lighten positions that I think are approaching fair value.
Well, myself, and when it comes to sort of like buying stocks, we discussed one company last week which was suggested by the audience, Grainger, which is the UK's biggest private landlord, and I decided to pull the trigger this week, so I've bought a full position, and it's basically just on the back of, you know, it's obviously very cheap. I'm just give you an indication, the net tangible assets, or should we say the EPRA, the EPRA net tangible assets, is about £3 compared to the shares at about £2.05 at the moment. It pays around about a 5% dividend, and it trades at sort of like 30% below EPRA net tangible assets. Cost of debt is fine, they're well funded, and their loan to value is less than 40%, which is likely to stay around there or come down slightly as they start selling their reversionary portfolio. And I think just rental properties are, you know, they're staying, you know, in demand as a lot of buy-to-let, you know, investors come out the actual market. So this is not a stock that's going to shoot the lights out, but I just think it's cheap. It's a good income stock. It's going to convert into a REIT in October. I'm going to put it into my ISAN, to my SIP, so it's going to be totally tax-free. So I'm pretty positive about it.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't properly researched it. I remember we talked about this one last week, Grainger.
Yeah.
Oh, Paul, can you remember to give me the ticker with the company name? Because
GRI, sorry.
Yeah, no, I've got this one, but just for all of them, because I'm listening to you talk and I can't find my records without the ticker, you see. So anyway, I like it. I need to do a bit more work on it. We last looked at it at Grainger on the 15th of May when the H1 results came out, which we mentioned all this last week. So yeah, you're right. EPRA NAV is £3. The shares are just over £2. All property shares, most of them are at a discount, but this looks particularly interesting. I think it's much easier than buying a buy to let and having all the hassle of having tenants, isn't it? Just buy shares in a buy to let and you can get a big discount to NAV as well. So I think it's interesting. And there was a financial firm today, I think it was one of the big fund managers, that said there are fabulous opportunities in markets for their funds at the moment on equities which hold physical assets.
Yes.
So a lot of the fund managers are looking at these sorts of things. So I think these big discounts to NAV could well narrow over time. And as you say, you get your divvies along the way as well. So, yeah, very interesting space to look at, I think.
Yeah. Just on that, in that same sort of sector, but on the commercial property, we had Wednesday Properties that came out with some news today. I think they were talking about Ticker is WSP. And it's only about $20 million market cap. It trades again about 30-35% discount to net tangible assets. They have very little vacancies, if any, and they have nothing in arrears at all for rental arrears. They sort of go for secondary properties in sort of commercial locations, largely industrial sort of factories or warehouses in sort of like outside major sort of conurbations. But I just wonder if you ever had a look at this one. It's not liquid enough for myself, but for 20 million market caps, you know, it might be something that people want to put some money in and to look as an alternative REIT.
Yeah, strange. I've put that ticker in, but it's coming up, but not with today's announcement, because I think we reported on it today. One of the team did. So I don't know quite why. That's caught me on the hop a bit here. Oh, I think I put the wrong date in. I put 16th of May. I found it.
Okay.
This is the trouble when you're rushing to a deadline. It dropped 2% this morning on an H1 trading update. I'm looking at Winkworth. Wednesday Properties. I'm all over the place today, Paul. Here we are. £7.60 a share. AGM trading update, 3 months to June. Portfolio remains fully let. No outlook comments. It's got a strong balance sheet. Loan to value is only 23%, which is very comfortable. And you've got a good 30 or 40% discount to NAV, 35% actually. Concentrated shareholdings. The yield is okay, but it's very illiquid. So I would personally, because you're going to have to pay such a wide bid offer spread with Wednesday Properties, I think I'd rather stick with Grainger, actually. Similar sort of discount. Why go for the tiny illiquid one when you can get similar metrics from a humongous one, you know?
Yeah, I guess one is in slightly different. One is in homes and residential properties, and then the other one's in corporate and commercial real estate, which is, you know, warehouses and manufacturing and stuff. So slightly it depends what asset you want to go to, but I'm with you. If I've gone for Grainger, because it just gives you a bit more property exposure, and also with Grainger, actually it could well be a takeover target. There's always been Lloyds has always been talked about. I think Land Securities as well has always been talked at as a potential predator.
Yeah.
And then of course you've got the big infrastructure guys, as we mentioned last week, that potentially
So with Grainger then, I'm imagining, because I haven't really properly researched it, I'm imagining they're just buying up new build housing estates, are they? Or do they buy in, because it's residential property, isn't it? Or do they kind of buy individual houses, buy and sell them? Do you know, Paul?
Well, we're going to have a call with the management team next week, so we'll spill all the beans next on next Thursday show. But basically, they build their own. It's build to rent, they do. And then they fund that largely through the selling of their reversionary older portfolio, which is when those tenancies come up for they expire, and then they sell it and then fund it through into build to rent. But
I see.
That's what they generally do.
Sounds very interesting. I'm looking forward to. Yeah, we're having a Zoom with them next week. If you just
hopefully next Tuesday. Okay, good. Let's move to the house builder sector, because all of them have been pretty badly hit this week. We've got three. Let's just quickly mention. We've got a big cap. We've got Barratt Redrow. Shares fell 10%. We've got Gleeson, the mid cap, which reported a couple of weeks ago. Again, they were cautioning the number of sales and the strength of the private housing market for sales. And then we've got Springfield as well. And they're all trading at significant discounts to net tangible book, pay a decent dividend yield, and have got all of them have got sound balance sheets. So let's just quickly go through the big cap. If somebody wants to go for a liquid big cap in the FTSE 100, Barratt Redrow.
So is that BTRW, I'm thinking? See what happens. Yes, here we are. It's come up. Yeah. 15th of July, that was yesterday. This put out a full year trading update. Now, I didn't understand why this opened more than 10% down. And what we've discovered is when that happens, it's usually because some of the premium brokers have slashed their forecasts, but private investors haven't been told, of course. So it's very unfair. That's often the case with an early spike down. We thought the The update itself from Barratt Redrow looked all right. It was adjusted profits in line with market expectations, integration of Redrow going well. But, you know, something in the update must have disappointed people. Possibly it said that the outlook for completions was going to be flat in the new year. So that was the one for, that's June 26th. So that's the only thing I could come up with. But it's now, that 10% drop took it well below NAV again. Incredible balance sheet, 6.4 billion market cap, net tangible asset value, and about 5.5 billion market cap. So you're getting 900 million pounds of assets in for free. I'm a bit of an ambulance chaser with these house builders. I like buying them when they are, when sentiment's so set against them that they just drop and drop and drop. And if you look at the sort of medium and long-term charts, those are exactly the times to buy because the NAV supports the price. So your risk reward is really quite asymmetrical in a positive way, I think. So I think it's a very good time now to be looking at these things again. We all know the kind of macro worries and interest rates and government policy and fire remediation. You know, there are all these various headwinds, but sentiment just ebbs and flows on those. And you're getting 4% yield on Barratt Redrow, as I say, absolutely bulletproof balance sheet. I like it. Yeah, don't hold any of them personally, but I'm sorely tempted to start buying some of these things. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, it did say, actually, I think with its London exposure, that it was seeing fewer international purchases and fewer...
Oh, OK. I didn't spot that bit. Thanks.
And fewer investor purchases. So where people, you buy properties for investment. But that will change. You know, it's once sentiment gets improved to sort of UK property again, you can see that. Yeah. Unless, obviously, a lot of millionaires are leaving the capital and therefore there's a lot of people, there's a lot of spare vacant property, which I think actually has happened to a certain extent at the really high end, but not quite in the sort of like the sort of middle end.
But I
do think a lot of there's an artificial tail headwind at the moment, the whole sector, which is just really those first time buyers. We saw a surge of new, you know, first time buyers coming into the market, heading into that help to buy at the end of March. And frankly, it's just taken the steam out in the last quarter. But I think it will normalise, particularly as you say, is when interest rates come down. So I'm with you. I think, you know, they're all flashing blue light, and on that basis, you know, if you want to go into housing or the housing market, it looks pretty good. I mean, I what's your favorite? I mean, I think out of all of them, my favorite would be Grainger, Gleeson's would be my sort of top pick of the housing sector.
Yeah, I think we mentioned this last week again. I'm a little bit disappointed with Gleeson's. They have blotted their copybook a couple of times now, and they fessed up to the fact they got internal issues and they've done some management changes. But that's the one that's got the potential to really scale up. You know, it can double in size, and that's what their medium term plan is. So I still like Gleeson. I have to say, Barratt Redrow, I think, is very, very good. Yeah. And, you know, we should get lower interest rates, although, of course, today with the inflation reading in the UK coming in a bit warmer than expected, that might possibly slow down the rate of interest rate, base rate falls. And I know they're not directly linked to mortgage rates, but they are correlated to a certain extent. I think it does. And you've got to remember, an average household where people are working, they've got 20% higher nominal income now than they had probably about 3 years ago. You know,
no, you're so right.
Yeah, so I think affordability is not maybe as stretched as people might think. But I mean, down in Bournemouth here, you can get nice flats for about 200 grand, which for a working couple is easily affordable. So, yeah, I'm actually, I think the time to buy is when the confidence has gone out like it has at the moment, I think. So I like to be contrary on these house builders. So, yeah, I do want to buy some of them for sure.
Okay, we'll just switch sectors to go to technology and software. We've got a couple of people, Ted Coleman and Ben Sharman, both asking about Beeks, what your latest thoughts are. I think they came out with some results this week or something.
Yeah, this is a bit frustrating, this share, because the figures that it came out with, yeah, here we are, 2 days ago, 14th of July. This was a trading update for June 25. By any measure, these were fabulous numbers. Beeks is producing terrific compound revenue growth. It's now profitable, although there were different interpretations of the profits and cash flows, which I respect from people with differing views on it. But they always seem to sort of snatch defeat from the jaws of victory by over-forecasting. And so it actually came out as a mild profit warning, despite the fact that you've got something like 25% organic annual revenue growth, a high proportion of which is recurring. They just set the forecast too high, and you don't get any credit for setting a forecast that's at 29% growth. But if you miss it and you get 25%, you're punished. So I really think they've got to sort out just, but the current year forecasts for June 26 are much more modestly set. So I think that, you know, it's 7 or 8% growth or something, which, and they've had $10 million of contract wins announced in June. So this should have been a good news announcement, were it not for the fact that the forecasts have been set unrealistically high. And they did give two specific reasons as to why they'd missed as well. It was just one contract slightly slipped past the year end, but has now happened. That's the Mexico stock exchange contract, which should be very lucrative, management reckon. And I think they had a small forex impact on the dollar, which is actually something that we're seeing. We've had a whole flurry of companies in the last week or so mention dollar weakness has curtailed their earnings. So that's something to bear in mind. If you have companies in your portfolio with dollar weakness, you know, you might get a 5% or more hit to profits from that. So, but I'm very positive on Beeks. Excellent outfit, around £2 a share. I think there's very little downside, and you won't find a faster organic growth software company on the whole market. And that's what Canaccord pointed out. They did a chart of all of them, the whole sector. Beeks is by far the highest compound growth. So the market's just fallen out of love with it for the time being. It's been like that since about, I think, February or March, hasn't it? When there was a bit of a uncertainty over changes to the business model. But I'm pretty confident it'll come back up again. So I'm happy to just run with Beeks and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it all depends on how you define the market, isn't it? Because I think NVIDIA would challenge that speed rate, because it was 100% last year.
Oh, no, I meant UK. Not the mega caps there.
Okay, we've got
big as well, don't they?
Yeah, we got Tony's asking about a stock we don't normally talk about, which is the Accesso Technology, which basically does software that goes into theme parks. I think it's got biggest customers, not quite a concentration of customers, but it does Alton Towers and the whole Merlin ones. It also does, I think it's Six Flags, and there's another one that Six Flags merged with out in the States. It's got about three or four really large, but I don't know what your latest thoughts are on this one. It was a darling about 10 years ago, and then obviously got hit by the pandemic, came back as they reopened a lot of the theme parks. It was originally known as Loku, I think it
That's
was.
Right.
I think Dave Strenner used to make a lot of money out of it. But
He made squillions on this, because he got them along to Mello when it was literally just a few pence a share. And I think it almost 1,000 bagged or something. And Dave held them all the way up. But I think he's held them most of the way down as well, unfortunately. But no, I mean, it was an incredible spot when it was absolutely tiny. But I think it got to about $1 billion market cap, which was ridiculously over the top. And it all started to unravel before the pandemic, actually, in about 2018. So recognizing it's had an absolutely stunning sort of track record, and it's not a bad business, Accesso. It is profitable and cash generative, and it's got an okay balance sheet, so I've got nothing against it. But I think now it's a bit of a stale story. It dropped 22% 5 days ago, 11th of July. Quite a sharp, it was a mild profit warning. Basically, they said revenues are going to be a bit lower because the theme parks are not as busy as expected. Plus, and this was the worst bit, they said calendar 2026, they're going to lose 6 million gross profit from a major customer who's not taking part of the contract offerings. It was a badly worded update where they fudged the issues, I think. And that's about a quarter of their gross profit. So if they're not going to find £6 million of cost savings, then I think, reading between the lines, it sounds like profits are going to go down. But they then said we've got a good pipeline and conversion rate. So it was kind of pluses and negatives, but the market didn't like it. Has it bounced since, Paul? Because it was 374 when I looked at the shares.
No, it's 123 at the moment. Sorry, 423 at the moment.
Well, so it has bounced a bit. Yeah, right. Yeah. No, it's bounced about 50p from the lows. Well, that's not too bad, is it? Right. From the lows.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I mean. We've stayed. We've just been amber on it all this year. We weren't terribly keen on it. In 28th of January and on 15th of April, I commented on Accesso before the profit warning, obviously, and I just said it looks X growth and a stale story, and I don't see any reason for the premium rating. So, you know, it's a bit cheaper now, but it doesn't pay any dividends. It's not clear what value they added from a whole splurge of acquisitions they did over the years. Doesn't really seem to have moved the dial much. So I'm a bit sceptical on Accesso. Nothing particularly wrong with it. You know, it's not an avoid for me, but doesn't float my boat. I think you talked to me about this one a couple of years ago, actually, Paul.
Yeah, I bought in before the pandemic and unfortunately got my timing exactly wrong when it closed. But one of those things, and then I sold out because I was wondering back in the depths in sort of February of 2020, just before we got lockdown, whether it was going to survive getting over the lockdown and had enough money, and I was convinced it needed to do a fundraise, but so I sold out, out, and then they did a fundraise at three times the level, the price level. At what I'd sold out, so it was just God's law. I got my timing totally. I've never seen a placing done at a premium of about 200%.
That's bizarre, isn't it? Yeah, I can't remember the specifics of that, but yeah, it does. As things stand now, I have to say, bit of a stale story, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Good. We've got Tucy's asking about Bloomsbury Publishing, which came out with I think it was a statement today, which was all in line. I think their fiction side of the business is doing well, and then their more sort of academic publishing side, the digital side, hasn't yet sort of like got to scale or to really sort of start it. What was your take on Bloomsbury?
Positive. I jumped the gun a bit, didn't I, mentioning this earlier? It was, this was one where I read I follow it quite closely, and I published a quick comment on it at about 10 to 8 this morning on my Substack, saying my conclusion was the good value, the forward PE is 12.7 times. It's oversold, good entry point now, maybe, So, and do you know what? People had half an hour to buy this morning before the price started moving. We're in very nervous markets at the moment, I think, for smaller caps. It's almost like everybody's watching, waiting on results publication to see what everyone else does, you know? My take on it was this is the time to buy. They've just put out inline update. The Sarah J. Maas books, they said, are still in the bestsellers list in the UK and US. I think there was one recently published. There's a J.K. Rowling launch, some sort of pocket Potter, I think they're calling it. That sounds like a new format, doesn't it, maybe? Launching in August. So this all sounded quite upbeat to me. And they're confident about the full year, strong pipeline of launches. So, yeah, a very reasonable valuation, I think. So I think, first thing this morning, you had half an hour to buy. And I think that was a canny buy for anyone who did so. Yeah, nice balance sheet as well with a bit of net cash. So, yeah, I like Bloomsbury. This valuation, I think it got a bit ahead of itself previously at sort of £6 to £7. But at £5 a share, I think it's good value, yeah.
Yeah, and also I think the CEO is very good. He's been there for a long time, Nigel Newton. Yeah. So, and you're right, 13 times PE. It's a very reasonably priced growth stock, that one, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And like you say, you've got that founder, owner, manager in there with such a good track record. And you're not being asked to pay a premium for it at all. You're getting it, I think, at a nice, attractive price today. So, yeah, I think this is very good. So green again on it. And we've been green all this year on three other occasions as well.
Moving sectors, we've got into retail. We've got the TJ09. He's asking about B&M, basically the discount retailer, which goes into sort of like retail outlets, essentially. Sells all kinds of different products. Came out with a trading update this week. What was your take on it?
Well, yeah. BME, this one, isn't it? I cover this closely because I've been circling it, looking to take an opening position. Oh, I forgot to say, I hold Bloomsbury Publishing personally.
Okay.
I've always got to disclose if I hold it. I just forgot. So I don't hold B&M European yet, but I want to buy it. Now, this is another one where 10% drop on a trading update that seemed pretty benign. The Q1 trading update, but as you pointed out, that usually means there's something buried in it that isn't so good. They even headed it positive, likes or something. Q1 trading update, this is up to 28th of June. Like-for-like sales up 1.3%, which I didn't think was too bad in the current climate. But it did say lower margins in some product categories. But then it said it's expecting higher margins, higher bought-in margins in the next quarter. Now, that, I think, is quite interesting because there could be read-across for other retailers from the weaker dollar. Cockney Rebel's been on about this for a while, and I think he might be onto something because, of course, goods that are imported by retailers are priced in US dollars. So that could mean retailers seeing higher gross margins this autumn, which could mop up, you know, all the wage and tax related higher costs. But there was no profit guidance from B&M, which a few people on a bulletin board said, oh, that's why the market didn't like it. You know, they declined to give us a trading update for the year. But I look back at the last Q1 update in 2024, and it was exactly the same format. They said, we'll give you full year guidance after the summer trading. So there was no change there. I saw some savage broker write-downs today. So it looks like, again, same old case of where the premium brokers and the big investors are given the steer first, that the forecasts are being slashed. Private investors like us find out after the price has already dropped. Yeah. But it is good value now. There's no doubt about that. So I'm very tempted.
It sort of plays a 6.5% dividend yield, 7x PE. To be perfectly honest, it almost looks too good a value because you've almost got your dividend yield higher than your actual PE ratio. I know they talked about some of their products, the FMCG, which is presumably the grocery-style products, not food, but non-food-style products. And it's getting pretty brutal in that supermarket area. If they have to start competing for cleaners and deodorants and other, you know, bits and bobs for against the supermarkets, then it becomes it gives even a lower margin business. I mean, their margins are 10%, but FMCG supermarket boys, their margins are less than 5%.
It's possible. But I mean, B&M is already a price competitive business. That's its USP, really. So I think it reminds me a bit of JD Sports conceptually, in that repeated small misses against forecast seem to cause a real ratchet down in share price and the rating that the thing's on, which seems to me to far exceed anything that's reasonable. So I think if you've got patience, I think JD Sports, which I hold personally, and B&M, could be nice recoveries. And you've got something similar at the moment in another one I hold, Hollywood Bowl, where everyone is expecting a profit warning because the weather's been maybe too hot for people to want to go bowling. But in the overall scheme of things, long term, that doesn't matter in the slightest. It'll just even out over time, you know. And again, it just chip, these shares go down. And I think they're very nice. You know, I'm a value investor at heart, so I love it when shares just keep going down because the market's just presenting you with a bargain, or you later find out that your analysis was wrong and they deserve to go down. So, you know,
it's never great though. If you're holding a share and it keeps going down, so you're always sort of like scratching your head thinking, have I got it wrong?
I know. I think one of the brokers, I think it might have been JP Morgan, dropped it, the target price on BME, to about £2, which was a very aggressive drop. So there's definitely been, you know, some premium brokers putting out bearish notes on this. You can find, actually, if you can't get hold of the broker notes, on ShareScope, there is a thing under the news service where you get little one-line summaries that come a little bit later in the morning of what the premium brokers have said. And I think there might be a similar thing on Stockopedia, possibly. So that's worth a look, that you might, you know, if you can't understand why a share is dropping, have a look a bit later in the morning and some of those might come up.
Yeah. Okay, we've got a question from Jim. He's basically asking about McBride, which operates a bit further up the food chain there. It provides sort of like cleaners and personal products, largely supermarket-owned brand, but also does contract manufacturing as well of these products to other brands, etc. It used to have a large pension deficit and was overgeared. Then the shares did really well. Anyway, they had a bit of a stumble today, down 13%. So any thoughts on McBride at all?
Yeah, I mean, the turnaround at McBride was absolutely extraordinary. A stunning achievement from management to go from, as you say, I mean, pretty much very close to the brink at one point, about a couple of years ago, but they radically improved performance. So, you know, huge respect for management and investors who spotted it early on, who multibagged. The only thing we've been saying on my Substack now for a while is that the problem with McBride, it doesn't have any obvious pricing power. It just manufactures products for supermarkets' own brand stuff, which, yes, has been very profitable. But what they're popular with customers as well. But what McBride said today that I think spooked the market, and it dropped about 12%, was that they said the supermarkets are now pushing them on cost and on price. Yeah. You know, and that's what we've said all along. We've said, look, you can't expect McBride to maintain that 7% operating margin. That is, a lot of that was because they nailed the prices down for a year and then the raw materials costs dropped. So we've always said with this, look, it won't be that long before the supermarkets come back and renegotiate and want lower prices. And that's pretty much exactly what McBride said today. It wasn't a profit warning. They said in line for a June 25. Zeus has lowered the revenues forecast for 26 and 27, but it's left the profit unchanged because it reckons they can recoup through cost savings and margins. I wouldn't want to hang my hat on that personally. I think when you get clear signs here, which the company admits to, that customers are now pushing back on price, that would be the point where I personally wouldn't want to get involved. So the PE, you know, I'd want to bank my profits and move on personally. But the PE, but that's up to each individual. The PE of 7 looks optically cheap, but I think it's cheap for a reason. And the pension fund and the debt are now nicely under control, so you don't have to worry too much about them. Are you tempted to buy the dip, Paul, on McBride?
No, I don't. Without any sort of major USP, just a manufacturer for other people's brands, it would never be, at any price, it wouldn't be something I'd particularly go for because it just lacks differentiation and pricing power, and you're beholden largely to the power of the supermarkets.
It's all about pricing power, isn't it? And I think you and me both prefer to invest in businesses where they've got something unique, something that they can achieve a 10 plus a minimum 10% operating margin.
On the same area, we've got Amanda. She's asking about Creighton's, which is basically, I think, does sort of personal products that for its own brands, but also for supermarkets and for contract manufacturers. The shares likewise are down 9% today. Is it the same sort of thing, pricing power and worries about margin compression going forward?
Well, not so much in this case. Creighton's has had quite a bumpy transition over the last couple of years. The old management sort of left with the tail between the legs, having made some duff acquisitions. And then I think it was in-house people who took over. They're a little bit odd, the management here, but they seem to be doing...
What do you mean, odd?
I don't know. I probably shouldn't have said that.
It's so, Pippa Clark, isn't it, the CEO?
No, I'm not referring to anyone individually.
Oh, okay, right, yeah, okay.
Quirky is a different word.
Yeah, okay.
It dropped 9% today on the results to March 2025. The numbers were good. PBT was up 130% to 3.5 million. So I think they've the newish management, I think, have sorted it out, which is really good. And they've been doing some cost cutting, and it's got a new strategy for these sort of it buys up these brands, doesn't it, for personal care type products.
Yeah.
We just can't get excited about it. I mean, it's on a PE of about 12. There's no forecast in the market. The outlook comments were mixed. They said the market conditions are challenging and they're struggling to pass on price rises to customers. But then they say they're quite excited about other things. So we just can't. We can't really take a strong view either way on Creighton's. The balance sheet is notably strong, though. Very nice, secure balance sheet. We just think we'll just go with neutral, Amber, on this one. Do you? It doesn't sound.
Do you play your vote? No, it's not something I'd particularly go for. But no. I would say you're right. I think it's about fairly priced, sort of 12 times PE, makes 6% EBIT margins, decent balance sheet. You know, I think it's a fair company and a fair price. So yeah, I wouldn't say it would be a takeover target. Probably not big enough, I would guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I agree with all of that. I think for me, to get me excited about it, I'd want some sort of catalyst, you know. So if they, I don't know, had bought a new brand or had developed a new brand internally that was going to become a huge consumer success, it's that type of angle on it that would get me interested. A lot of my friends are in this stock in quite a big way, actually, some of them. So I can't be too rude about it.
Okay, we've got Carco.
Not that I want to be particularly rude about it. I'm just neutral.
Yeah, okay. We've got Carcosa, who's asking about another retailer. We've got Sosandar, which is the ladies' wear, I think. They were all online, and then they decided to open some physical stores, and they've raised some money. Unfortunately, I think they've stumbled a bit. The shares were down again today. What's your quickly latest on this one?
Well, I like this at the time of the original float, and they've done a great job. And the joint CEOs, Ali and Julie, are just the loveliest people you can meet. So it's always difficult, isn't it, when you've followed management and had lunch with them and things, to then see it not really panning out as we would have hoped. I mean, it's incredibly difficult to build a fashion business from scratch. So I'm not in any way knocking their achievements, but it dropped 22% yesterday to only 6.25p because they missed the figures for the March 25 results. They'd already put the trading update out saying we're going to make 0.5 million BBT, which is not very good, but it's tough macro, you know, and clothing retailing is so difficult. But then the figures came out and it was minus 0.1 million. So a 600 gram miss, which you can't, you know, you can't miss the numbers when you put the trading update out. So that was a bit of a faux pas. And it was basically mainly 2/3 of it was a stock write-off that the auditors insisted on. So that got me looking at the balance sheet. And I'm afraid the inventories figure on the balance sheet is way, way, way too high. So I think this is the tip of the iceberg of problems in there of, I think, a lot of inventory they can't sell. And it's almost a year's worth of cost of sales, not far off, which, I mean, it should be 6 weeks for a retailer. So they badly overstocked, I'm afraid. And it's only a matter of time before they have to kill their gross margin to shift the gear. You know, they're focusing on full price sales, but you can't do that. It's the customers who decide what price they're going to pay. And I think there's another profit warning in Sosandar. So not for me, I'm afraid. And the new store openings, the physical stores, obviously haven't worked. They've opened 6 stores. They're now saying we're pausing those until we've made them profitable. Well, you don't open any more, do you, if you open 6 and they don't work? So I'm sorry to say it, because I love them to bits, the people there. And I don't think it's really going anywhere, I'm afraid. So it's difficult to see what would change. So for that reason, it's not for me. But I wish them all the luck in the world in improving it.
Yeah. Well, I like to be a dunce in ladies' wear in terms of the knowledge-wise and expertise, because it's such a competitive area. And it's just they don't take any prisoners. If you haven't got the perfect combination of price, product, you know, promotion and marketing and all that kind of stuff, then unfortunately you get absolutely annihilated, and some of the brands do. I mean,
for all its brand strength, it's not making any money.
Yeah, no. And there was another one which I remember, I think you used to own about 3 or 4 years ago, that was about, went down to about 3p and then got taken out at about 30p, and I can't remember which one it was. It was a retailer about 3 or 4 years ago on a week. Anyway, that one went bust because it got taken out.
I know the one you mean. That was Seraphine. Yeah,
that's it, Seraphine.
Yeah, I got so lucky on that. I shouldn't have bought them in the first place. I took a big risk. But I took the view that the venture capital firm that owned about 40% of it wouldn't let it go bust. That actually was lucky, because they did buy it out. It only cost them a few million. But, you know, I did very, very well on that, because I took quite a big position in it. You're right. About a week ago, it went into administration, didn't it?
Yeah. And it just shows you it's brutal. You know, basically, when it comes to sort of retail, if you get the wrong formula, or it's just not the perfect formula, then they don't take any prisoners. Okay, let's switch sectors. Let's go back up to tech. We've got David. He's asking about, well, actually, it's the profit warning of the day. He's asking about Carrero Network Security, which I think we've talked about before. It basically does distributed denial of network protection systems that go largely into I think it's the telco sector, the big guys, the data centers, the cloud operators. It isn't just sort of like, you know, small mum and pop or corporates. It goes into the really big guys. They had a big partnership with Juniper. Anyway, the shares are down almost 40% today. As I've seen a slowdown in that telco sector, which is actually not a surprise because there was actually a profit warning by Ericsson, which makes all the telco network equipment about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Anyway, what was your take on it? It seems to be, unfortunately, you know, capital goods, durable goods seem to be not in vogue at the moment, given the uncertainty with the trade tariffs.
Well, I'm not. I've never really understood the valuation of this share. I wrote about it in my colleague Dave wrote about it in 7th of January, saying it looked fully valued. And then I wrote about it on 1st of April. This is all on my Substack, of course, that people are very welcome to come and free trial it and see what you think. Both Dave and I thought it looked really expensive. I mean, earlier this year, it was valued at about 100 million. Career in network security, and it doesn't have a history of profitability. It's sort of eked back towards just above break even. So we didn't understand the valuation. That's why we marked it amber in January and April. But unfortunately, today it's really blotted its copybook with an H1 trading update, which is a profit warning, below expectations. It's doing, I mean, Dave was a bit kinder on it than I was. He wanted to go with amber, which is neutral. I wanted to go amber red, but he persuaded me that we should be kind. It's one of these, it's shifting from licenses to SaaS. Which Dave is more sympathetic towards than I am, my colleague Dave. It also talks about delayed customer decision making. It's worth noting that the founder, I think it must be, owns quite a big stake here. I'm thinking, was it 38%? It's quite a bit, or was that? It's around about that. So owner managed, running a bit low on cash, we think, but it reassures on that, saying it thinks it's got enough. But it then on the says that it's in the late stages of arranging an overdraft facility. So they obviously want to get a bit more headroom. So might be a bit of dilution risk there. I can't for the life of me see why it's still valued at nearly 50 million quid. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't look a very good business to me. But I don't know. You must have looked at this one, Paul, haven't you?
Yeah, I think the reason why, you know, it gets a more premium valuation is because the technology is excellent. I think it is best in class for that, really. The analogy to my view is like Interseed, i.e. Is in cybersecurity, competes against the big dogs, the likes of Palo Alto and Checkpoint Software and stuff like that. But it's the creme de la creme on sort of like two-factor authentication. It's got the US DOD, the OD and stuff. These guys do the creme de la creme distributed denial of service protection equipment to the best of breed customers. It goes into the telco guys, it goes into the massive data centers. It doesn't go typically into your normal traditional router that, you know, your retail outlet down the road will put in, because these things go for over $100,000, you know, dollars a shot, or even $1 million a shot. They're big pieces of equipment on a contract. So I think that's because it's such a premium quality technology. I think that's why people recognize it has value outside of the financials. Owned by somebody else. However, having said that, I think its largest channel partner, which has had a relationship for a long time, Juniper, who basically do a lot of selling of this because they're a big telco network equipment supplier. They've just been bought by Hewlett Packard Enterprises. And that closed about 2 weeks ago. So I would just be hesitant at the moment because I'd like to see that shake out, because these relationships can change when there's a big ownership change. You know,
that's a good point. Yeah, you had that with what was it, with Eagle Eye, didn't you? Exactly problem killed its profits. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'll be one. Okay, we've got John Cannadine, actually, just on Eagle Eye. He's asking for an update. Now, John, what we'll do is Paul and I are going to speak to the management team hopefully next week, and then before the show, and then we'll come back on that one because they'll be able to give us a better insight on Eagle Eye, because they came out with, I think it was a trading update or something this week. But let's not do it twice. And then we've got Paul the Parrot. He's asking about MTI Wireless, I think. He says they've got a lot of drone management support technology coming in the next few years. I don't know what your thoughts on it. Israeli technology, it's been on the market for some time, I think.
Yeah, it's MWE, isn't it?
WWE, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't trained you yet, Paul, to say them, have I?
Yeah,
I have to keep nagging you.
Yeah, you do.
I'm very persistent. This was, we like MTI Wireless Edge. I wouldn't normally touch Israeli companies or any overseas companies listed on AIM, but I think I've mentioned before, I have two simple tests. Do they pay regular dividends? And have they been around for a few years? And if they tick both those boxes, I think they're usually safe to invest in. I like this. I reviewed MTI Wireless Edge on the 7th of July, so quite recent. Rose 7% on 3 defense contract wins. So it might get a bit. It's got several divisions, I think 3 or even 4 divisions, one of which is doing military antennae related to drones. I think it looks interesting, definitely. And you're getting a good dividend yield. The products are obviously quite topical. And you've got a nice balance sheet with net cash. So I think it's a little bit of a overlooked share that could get a re-rating, actually. Is it one you know, Paul?
I used to own it about 20 years ago.
Wow.
So it's a hell of a long time. Because what I liked about it, it had basically these flat panel radar or wireless communication devices that were going to go into wide area networks. Without using wireless, and so it was a bit of a really good spot at that particular point in time. And then frankly, I think it got blown up at the during the Great Financial Crisis, which is when I sold it before heading into it. So I'm with you. I know it sounds a bit crazy. I tend not to go for Israeli companies. I'm not putting any dispersions on this one because it's had a great track record and it's got a really good management team. But I prefer, if it gets taken over, then it can get a bit of a pain in terms of you having to show your passport to get your avoid withholding tax and all this sort of stuff, which is not a problem. But, it just becomes a bit of a. So I just find these easier fish easier places to put your rod in, sort of stuff. But no, I'm with you. I think it's good technology.
But you did very well. I remember years ago, you did extremely well on a stock that I held. You had about 100 times as many as me. a thing called, we both held, Pilat Media.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was Israeli, and you got a great outcome. You got a bagger out of that, didn't you?
No, I know, yeah. It just as I don't normally go into those. That was run by British, English guys who were based. But anyway, I'm not, it's nothing to do with, it just is sort of like, I try and stick with sort of like, stuff that I'm more aware of and more knowledge of.
I mean, I suppose you could argue the other angle on it is that a lot of investors, because of macro geopolitical stuff and the war going on and all the rest of it, a lot of people may not want to hold Israeli shares, which could mean that the good ones are better value for everyone else.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, yeah, no, too right. Yeah, yeah, that's a very good point. Okay, we got George Roach. He's asking about Cake Box, which does these luxury, fancy cream cakes. And they also bought Ampala Sweets, which is an Indian sweets and desserts business that they're going to try and franchise out. The shares have really done well, actually, over the last 2 years. They've done sort of like a turnaround. Yeah. What's your view on Cake Box?
Cake Box, we like it. Yeah, we've reported on it 3 times this year, March, June and July 15th. So that was yesterday, wasn't it? We've been green. That's our 5-star rating on each occasion. So actually, the shares haven't changed much in price. I don't know if they dipped. They probably dipped down in between those dates, but it was pretty much the same price, £1.88. Very nice self-funding rollout of more stores. They've got, I think, about 250 stores now. They're probably, I would imagine, I don't think they've said this, but I'm wondering if Cake Box might be nearing capacity, because they tend to be situated in, I asked the readers on this, and one of them said, they tend to be situated in areas with a high concentration of British Asians who are non-Muslims. I think that was the right thing. So the other Middle Eastern type religions, have I got that the right way around? That don't eat eggs, basically.
Yeah,
that's right. So non-Muslim British Asians. So you're looking at the other smaller religions. And so that limits the footprint a bit in terms of the total number of stores potentially, but they don't seem to be having any trouble expanding because it's, I'm sure it's not just in those sorts of areas, but I think that gives them a bet, if you like, a, you know, more, a bigger customer base. They've got 251 now in total. They're franchised, so it's capital light for the central company. If you look at the earnings per share progression, it's just like that. It's fantastic. Mm. You get about a 5% dividend yield. The balance sheet's okay. Yeah, we like it. We think it did have a major, massive mess up a couple of years ago when a former CFO was... was dishonest, basically. He did some insider dealing right before a profit warning, which, you know, you can't do. And I think there were audit problems as well, and you know, it was a mess. But they really paid the price for that. But fair dues to them. They brought in a new finance guy who sorted it all out, and it's been clean as a whistle ever since. So, yeah, I like Cakebox. I think it's good.
Yeah, well,
you've followed this positively for years, haven't you, Paul?
Yeah, just before that, I'll just say that is that's a view that Paul maybe says he doesn't really believe that, but that was something you could speculate on in terms of the previous CFO. I mean, there's no evidence to say that he ever did that. Just to be 100% crystal on it.
I know you've got to cover yourself, but you can see where the trade was, and you can
see where
the profit warning was. But that's my personal view. No, don't sue Vox, sue me.
No, don't sue Paul either. I mean, I love that. That's how my go. When I'm on a birthday cake, it's my go-to provider. They're great. They love it. They're absolutely delicious. Really perfect. Oh. The family. My dad had his 80th birthday about 3 years ago, and we got this lovely platter out, and everybody loved it from all different ages. You know, lovely fresh cream, dead cold, and they basically delivered it to the house. So yeah, it was all good.
Oh, that sounds very good. Yeah, because I've had slightly mixed reviews from my readers about the product. Mm. So I'll have to try the product and just have a very small slice.
Yeah, okay, cool. We've got three people asking about it. We've got Stefan, Michael S. and Rifsofoff, who are all asking about Card Factory, you know, the UK retailer for all things greetings and cards. I know this is an old fave from the Cockney Rebel.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's... Oh, yeah, we had... What do we have on... sorry, we have had quite recent... Oh, no, May, that is. 7th of May. So, yeah, we've not had anything since then. So my view hasn't changed at all. I think it's extraordinary. Optically, just seems extraordinarily cheap. If you crunch the numbers and the forecast, it should be £1.50 to £2 a share. But it just resolutely refuses to go above about 90p or a pound. I think it's back down to about 85p or something, isn't it now? Yeah. I on the fundamentals, I cannot see anything wrong with it. So I just don't know why the market... There was a big overhang, wasn't there?
I think
that cleared. So,
do you still own it, Paul?
Yeah, it's one of my core positions. I don't trade in and out of my core stuff. I just hold it and wait for it to revalue or warn on profits. But I can't see anything wrong with Card Factory, other than I think you might have mentioned before that they've not really made any impact on the online card space. Whereas, of course, you've got Moonpig, which incidentally is actually looking quite cheap now. Moonpig's sold off quite a bit, and I think that looks quite good. Moonpig's, you know, fabulously profitable, but a terrible balance sheet. Whereas Card Factory is also very profitable, but is on a much, much lower rating. So I think it's got scope to... I think it's just a question of having to be patient, we've missed something that's fundamentally wrong with it. But I mean, I've looked through the numbers time and time and time again. I can't see anything wrong with Card Factory. It's not your sort of thing, is it, really, Paul?
No, it isn't. No, but then, but just on that move, just on Moonpig, etc. Out of the two, that's the one you'd go for. Is I know it's been struggling on its experience, hasn't it? Because I think it did. It bought Red Letter Days, didn't it? Which hasn't seemed to work. It also bought effectively another sort of like DIY digital card production business, Greets, I think, out in Holland. But the Moonpig brand in the UK seems to be doing okay. I think it's just the acquisitions which hasn't gone well. But I was like you, I was looking at the valuation for sort of like a supposed, you know, tech company, and it trades at 13 times PE. And, you know, I think it's got a bit of debt. That was the only thing.
Yeah, the balance sheet's horrible. But you see, the last update, I almost went positive on it, but I couldn't bring myself to. I stayed neutral on Moonpig. That was 26th of June when the April 25 results came out. You see, earnings per share are up 18% to 15p. And it's doing a £60 million buyback, which I actually think is irresponsible because they haven't got the balance sheet to be doing buybacks. They're doing it out of debt. But it does generate a lot of cash flow. And the debt is only 1x EBITDA. So, you know, on that measure, the debt's not excessive. Yeah, £57 million impairment on experiences. But I don't think that should have surprised anyone because we've known really for a couple of years that they really messed up and overpaid for a rubbish business when they did that acquisition. So I'm surprised it's drifted down when the forecasts are actually, as you say, only for a PE of about 12 or 13. So I think Moonpig could be worth a fresh look, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Wouldn't be surprised, actually, if private equity bought it back. They listed it on the market originally. It's one of those things that goes back and forth. They'll list it again in about 5 years' time. Okay, we've got Drew. He's asking about timber merchant James Latham. I guess more appropriately, just that whole sort of building products. If the housing market isn't doing so well, it's still sort of like, you know, a bit of status quo. But anyway, on James Latham at all, any quick thoughts?
Love it. Absolutely. One of my favorite value shares. The balance sheet is insane. I mean, it's almost at par with market cap, the net tangible asset value, family owned and controlled, very conservatively run. Yeah, high margins, good recent performance. And again, you're being offered the shares on a PE of about 12 or something with a bulletproof balance sheet and loads of surplus capital on it. I absolutely love it. Yeah, I'm always green when I review Latham. So, yeah, we've not had any news since 26th of June. I don't think there's likely to be anything particularly untoward. They've already said they're no, actually, this is quite interesting. They said on 26th of June, gradually improving market conditions, and quote, most customers are more confident now than they were this time last year, end of quote. So that's quite interesting. Green shoots possibly with Latham, but I haven't really seen green shoots from any other building supplies companies. Have you, Paul, or are there any I've overlooked?
Well, one I was just going to go to was Top Tiles, and they did actually see an improvement in Q3 in selling tiles. And I think they sell, is it floor tiles, kitchen tiles, bathroom tiles, any type of tiles, basically. And then they came out with a better set of numbers. I was just going to sort of get your thoughts on that one, because is it something to do that a bit of a timing that people have bought houses heading into the Help to Buy scheme, and therefore they now need to tile some of them? I really don't know. But anyway, what was your take on their improved last quarter performance?
I like it. You jogged my memory. I knew there was one, at least one that in the sector that was doing better. And I think Wix as well. Wix gave a reasonably positive update. So I stand corrected, correct myself. There are some green shoots with some of the better companies. Yeah, I moved up from amber green to green on Tops Tiles on the 2nd of July. I don't hold any myself, but I would quite like to buy some, actually. I think this is a good business. They're starting to show an accelerating sales trend. I think that was what they said. And they said the trade buyers are stronger than homeowner sales to homeowners. So annual cost increases are a headwind of £4 million, they said, and margins are going to be higher as well. So I think it is the sector leader, I think, isn't it, Top Styles? Although presumably, they'll be competing against all the big DIY chains. I did have a thought about this yesterday that might slightly reduce that optimism, in that bathroom fitting supplier Norcross, NXR, which is very good value, another very nice business, reasonably priced, that reported yesterday. They're buying a Norwegian maker of these flat panels that you use in shower enclosures and bathrooms. And I did some research on their website, this Norwegian company. And apparently what a lot of people are doing now when they have their bathrooms redone is, rather than getting a tiler in to do all the individual tiles, you buy these panels. They're a meter wide and they're 2.4 meters high. And you basically just glue them onto the existing tiles and they interlock and cut them to the right size. much, much quicker and easier than removing and adding tiles. So I'm wondering if that might be chipping away at Topps Tiles position. So we'd need to find out what percentage of Topps sales are bathroom tiles, because I think it's mainly floor tiles, isn't it?
Yeah. Could be. I mean, they just saw an improving last quarter. Over the last three quarters, they've had a better last 3 months than they had in the previous 6 months. So it doesn't seem to be impacting them at the moment anyway. It's just as interesting why they're selling so much more. You know, I don't know whether a competitor's gone bust or something like that.
Oh, good point. I don't know on that front. And I think also when you get these recessionary periods in any industry, you then do get pent up demand, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and because fashions and tastes do change, you know, and people, I think young to middle-aged people in this country seem to be highly tuned in to having the latest looking bathrooms and kitchens, don't they?
Yeah. Maybe
because of all the TV programs about home makeovers. I don't know. So
I think you're right.
Yeah, it could be, couldn't it? You'd have to get bathroom fitters in and decorators in to replace any work that Lawrence Llewellyn, what's his name, had done. Do you remember the people who burst into tears when they saw his makeover they did to their house?
Don't give a wife any ideas. Anyway, out of Topps Tiles or Norcross, what do you prefer? They trade at roughly, if you look at it as an EV EBIT multiple, because they've got different balance sheet strengths. Someone's got one that's cash, one that's got a bit of a pension deficit. But if you look at it at the EV EBIT level, they trade at just around about six, both of them. But any preference between the two?
I'd buy half of each. I'd buy half position side in both. Now, the pension at Norcross is going to be finished by June 27. So that's pretty much dealt with. And I think they've closed down a problematic division and they're cleaning the business up very nicely. And I don't think it deserves the discount. The only thing is this Norwegian acquisition was a big one. It was about 40 or 50 million euros. So it's about 20% of Norcross's market cap that's being funded through debt. So do bear in mind the debt position at Norcross will pro forma will now be 1.8 times EBITDA, which is kind of at the top end of what I'd personally be prepared to pay. So I think they're both really good businesses with good track records currently at reasonable prices. I don't hold either, but you know, don't be surprised to see them popping up on my portfolio at some point, maybe.
Yeah. Just switching sectors, we've got a guy asking about Cerulean. He says it keeps on going down. Apologies, I've lost your name. But there's a chap anyways asking about Cerulean, which does the telco software that goes. It used to be a real darling. I don't know your latest view on this one. It still looks relatively expensive. But
what price is it, Paul, at the moment?
Let me just put the chart up. Hang on. What is it? £14.63.
Oh, that's come down a bit more. Now, it's a fabulous business, Cerulean, CER. Yep. Amazing track record. No question about that. So this is all splitting hairs in a way. The big problem here was the CEO dumped a big, big slug of stock. There was... Yep. At a substantial discount, that was the problem. It was the stock was offered through a proposed secondary placing at a 21% discount. That's far too much. And also, the CEO disposal was very considerably upsized. So he ended up selling, I think, about 10% of the company, which is about a third. And nobody likes that. You know, it surprises me that people line up to take these placing stocks, but I suppose they probably thought, well, we're getting a 21% discount, but it's definitely spooked the market big time. Have you got the? I'm on a different window. Have you got the chart there, Paul?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, no, that's got the chart. I mean, basically, over the last,
it doesn't look that much of a difference on the long term chart, does it? But
on a year basis, it's just really, really. Yeah. It's over the last few months, isn't it? It's come down a lot.
Yeah. So that has dented my confidence in Cerulean a bit. The other thing to bear in mind is it is dependent on large lumpy contract wins. Mm. So, you know, as we know with those type of stocks, sooner or later, there'll be a half year where, you know, they're up against a tough comp and they don't land the deals they expected and bang, you've got a profit warning. So I've cooled on this a bit. So I'm amber green on it now. So I still like it, but I was green up to April. That was when it was about 13 quid. But then I think it overshot on the upside. What's the valuation metrics now, Paul, on Cerulean? Have you got the 4P there?
Yeah, it still looks at about 24 times next year's FY26, September FY26. 24 times PE. So it's still not, you know, but these things can be taken out at any time, isn't it? You know, they're darlings that...
I mean, the founder still has a big, big stake in it. And again, owner-managed business, fabulously run. It is, don't get me wrong, it's a real quality business, I think, Cerulean. And it's got, you know, pretty much open-ended growth potential. So I do like it. But that, I think, given that the CEO just sold such a large stake, I'd want it on a PE in the mid-teens, really.
Yeah. Good. We've got a question from Mr. Greensprout here, Paul. He says... He says, can you give him a share suggestion so he can make enough money for his wife to leave him?
I don't know how to reply to that. I mean, we don't really do share tips as such, do we?
No, so. I don't either. All I would say is I've just bought Grainger, and it isn't one you're going to make an absolute killing on. It should be a steady eddy that pays a good dividend and over time should move up as interest rates, say, come down, the housing market stabilizes.
Yeah, I was going to say, when Mr. Greensprout's strapped for cash, you know, maybe his dividends in Grainger will allow him to sort of have an occasional treat in his retirement. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, let's finish on one final tech. We've got a telematics company, Cortix Technology. I think now the founder came back, and they basically do telematics systems, i.e. vehicle tracking and asset management for a whole bunch of small, medium enterprises, largely around the UK, maybe some in Europe as well. I guess it competes against the likes of Microlease, which is the sort of the big dog in the fight.
It's more at the individual and small SMEs level. Quarter.
Yeah.
It's very small. So it's not really a direct competitor to the fleet operators.
Yes.
I mean, I am conflicted on this because the CEO lives the founder lives near me, so he's a friend, so I can't be rude about this company, but I don't want to be rude about it anyway. I actually was Amber in January, but then I moved up to Amber Green in March because all the KPIs started to turn more positive. He's done an amazing job turning it around, I have to say. Again, it's the owner's eye. I love that. You know, they're just so committed and passionate about the business that, you know, he tells the story about how he set it up on his kitchen table, literally. Yeah. And very, very nice business. And, you know, international growth now coming through. The H1 trading update was good. PBT was up 30%. I think probably valuation-wise, maybe about right for the time being. But the KPIs are really strongly moving in the right direction. Generates lots of cash. He sorted the business out. So on fundamentals, I really like Quartix. I think people should do well on that long term. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think it's a SaaS type business. ARR, is it, recurring revenue stream, high gross margins.
The product's obviously good because he said, you know, look, they do this graph on the presentations showing the cohorts, you know, and they just—it's just the standard thing. They just load on more clients, and then the clients are sticky, and they do. They're happy with it. I don't think they compete directly on sort of product features or anything like that. I think a lot of it is effective marketing spend. Yeah. And then once people have signed up, it's a very low value purchase, you know, I don't know what it is, but I don't think it's much more than about £10 a month, which, you know, if you're a gardener or something, or you're whizzing around in a van, you know, I just said to him, why doesn't it work on, why don't they just use Google? And he said, well, this tracks the vehicle and the owner of the vehicle. You know, it's just much more sophisticated. And the proof of the pudding is in those numbers. You know, it really is a very nice business, I think, Quartix.
Yeah. I'll give you a suggestion here. When you next meet your friend, what's his name again? Andrew Walters. When you next meet him, tell him to have a chat with Microlease, because I was just doing their market cap. Quartix is £110 million. They're below the £250 million, sort of like when they get the serious institutional interest.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Microlease is market cap is £150 million. So if you add 150 to £210 million, they both trade at 22 times PE. So you can do a fair all share merger. You get £260 million market cap. Bingo. You get more liquidity, higher valuation, and you can cut out a whole lot of You know, sort of overhead costs. That reminds me of Belvoir, and there was the property franchise company.
Yeah, I was just going to say exactly the same. Although I suppose the counter, and I agree with all of that, but the counter argument with Quartix and Microlise is that they're both actually on pretty punchy ratings. So it just shows, I think, the institutions will buy stuff below 250 million if it's exceptional and if it's perceived as growth companies. But still a good idea. I'll put that to him when we next meet up for a pint.
Yeah, well, I mean, you'd get the 22 times all share merger, you'd still be on, you know, if you had a 22 times PE, but you stripped out a shed load of overheads, your margins would go from 20% EBIT to around about 30% EBIT. If you had 22% on the 30% EBIT, you'd be a much more valuable business.
Yeah, but that'd be good idea.
Okay, we got one question. Questa Ware, he's basically saying with Grainger, he says, is there any effect in the case of the courts in relation to the leasehold reform? Now, I'm going to hold that question, Questa Ware, because we'll try and answer that next week. And I presume you're referring to the government's decision to give rights to leaseholders of property from the property developers. It shouldn't really affect them, but I'm sure that's the question. But
yeah, but anyway, is that about things like the no-fault evictions and whatnot?
I don't think it's that. I think it's basically, you know, that leasehold freehold thing, which the housing builders were doing that reform where they were going to give the right of owners of property to buy the freehold off those sort of long-term peppercorn rents. That's what it was. But anyway, we'll put it to Grainger. So well, thanks everyone for your questions. Next week we'll be at 2 p.m. on Thursday. We'll come back hopefully with our insights on Grainger and Eagle Eye from speaking at the teams. And thanks again, Paul. Brilliant run through.
And thank you for fixing up those Zooms for us next week. I think it's a really great format where you and I, you know, jointly meet a company and then give the feedback back here. I think, it's a brilliant initiative. Thank you.
Brilliant. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everyone. Bye for now.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.